and welcome to Two Fat Expats. And when we say fat, we're not talking bathroom scales or excess luggage. Two Fat Expats are all about making the most of your expat adventure and filling it up with as much as you can so that when it's all over, there's no regrets. You've lived a fat expat life. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie expat who's based in Doha, Qatar. And I'm joined by Nikki Moffat.
Hello.
Another Aussie, but Nikki's in Hamburg, Germany. We've lived in 12 countries between us. We consider ourselves experts in all matters of the geographically challenged. Between us, we've given birth in 6 countries, and we know what it's like to pack up yet another kitchen, start looking for another job, and wave goodbye to that brilliant hairdresser it took you 12 months to find. We've both made those first steps into the brand new office, or worse, the new school, and at times we've found ourselves jobless, friendless, and starting afresh all over again. Each week we talk to expats who are from all over the world, and we discuss our favourite finds, our biggest stuff-ups, and we get the best tips for packing it all in. Okay, are we ready to go? Let's do this. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm great, just great, Kirsty Rice. Ari's over, the sunshine and the school break's on right now, and I'm planning our Christmas holiday to Australia, which we've had to delay booking for a few little reasons, but it's full steam ahead now. So it's all happening. How about you? How's the house today? A little bit quieter?
Oh, the house is very quiet. For those who are unaware, I dropped 2 children back at the airport last night. Child number 2 and 3. So after having all 4 children here, and now it's just me and the little guy. And of course, my husband is in China. So yes, it's all a little bit quiet, but oh, just that awful, awful feeling of, you know, it's so freaking busy when you're heading to the airport with the kids, you know, packing bags and last minute showers and I can't find my phone chip and quickly eat this, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And then you race and you get through and you check in and you get to the thing and you watch them snake their way all through the immigration line to get to the desk, and you still have that heart thumping, I hope everything works and they get through okay, and then they're gone and it's dead quiet and you're on your own in the car and every sad possible song that could come on does come on, and there's just that complete feeling of emptiness. Do you know, it's awful.
I don't know it, but I do believe you, and I'm very empathetic.
Did you ever have to do, I guess you probably didn't with Sam. See, when I first married G, we moved to Perth where, you know, I knew one person, I think, and I went to work. But G used to travel a lot back then, and I, back in those days, used to drive him to the airport, which I don't think I've done again for the last 20 years. But I used to drive him to the airport, and I used to cry on the way home. I would say goodbye, and I'm sure I even used to walk him into the airport, which is just bizarre.
That means you have to pay for parking. We don't do that in our house.
No,
it's always
the
drop and go.
We never do it at our house, like even ever. Like I don't even have my parents arrive at the airport. Do you know, I can never understand. I have a beautiful girlfriend who always says, oh, I'll come and meet you at the airport. And I think, no. Like, let me get home, have a shower, put some milk in the fridge, you know, do all those things, and then let's catch up. But, you know, catching up after 20 hours of flying, I don't know, something happens, doesn't it, over time where you want to skip that bit.
Yes. Yeah. Totally. Yeah, we live very close to the airport. I'm not sure how close you live, but it's like a 15-minute drive for us. So
yep.
I often get a text message or a call, can you pick me up? And I say, How about a Moya, which is basically our equivalent of Uber here in Hamburg? I must say I do go from time to time to pick up, but it's only if you're out the front at the right time and I'm driving by, get in. I'm not barking and waiting for you.
Anyway, Nikki, let's get on with the show. So this week on the podcast, we're talking to those incredible people who have started something from nothing. Something with their own hands, something they made or built or grew or created, a business. And I am loving this episode, the conversation that was started on the Facebook group of just these incredible people that were able to travel to a brand new country and see a niche or feel a need or create something for others. And you know, Nikki, we have in this series, we've been very focused on telling the stories of expats who inspire us. And this one for me is one of those.
Absolutely.
So I interviewed Kimberly Sheedy, who started Starfish Nurseries in Doha. And anyone who's moved to Qatar with young children will have heard of Starfish Nurseries because there's about four of them here in Qatar now. Kimberly also has a nursery in Abu Dhabi. I think she kicked that one off a couple of years ago. She's an Aussie. She's a psychologist by trade, but came to Doha with her husband who worked in hospitality. I just firstly want to apologize for the sound in this interview because Kimberly was in the car and I was racing because I had kids at home and things to do. But I began by asking her what made her start the business, and was it just that she'd moved somewhere where she couldn't find what she was looking for? And this is what she said.
There was a complete niche in the market, especially like 14 years ago. And I could see that there was a real niche in the market in Doha.
Yeah. And was it that you couldn't see anything like you'd like to have?
Yeah, there was nothing really here that came up to that standard. But you know, I wasn't equipped to set up a nursery. I think I just had the vision and I know what I wanted. And I also wanted to get out of the rut and be more independent in a new country because I could just see, you know, the growth of Doha and I wanted to be a part of that. So I knew that there was definitely that niche. And I'm a very creative person, so I knew that I could add something extra. Also then employing people that are smarter than me in that profession, obviously to build on my business and to make it really great.
And, you know, Kimberly, I think so often people get ideas like you, but they get frightened of the roadblocks. Like they think, well, that's just too hard. You know, I'm going to need a local business partner, or I'm going to need more money than I have, or what if we get moved again? Like, what do you think it was that kept you going to go, yep, I'm going to make this happen? Like, how did you get past those roadblocks?
I think having the right information that I needed, which back then it was quite limited. It's a lot easier now. They were the roadblocks, and obviously understanding the logistical of the government and how to set up a business like that. But I did find back then it was a lot easier. I think now there's a lot more roadblocks because they've become, you know, they've got the ministries here have got the help of international people now, so the standards are a lot higher. Great, and it should be like that. On a personal level, the roadblocks I had is when I moved here with my ex-husband, we were schooling or housing and things like that, and I just wanted it better. I mean,
yes,
you know, I guess growing a business is like the first, when you become a mother for the first time, you kind of you get better and better as you do it. I've got three kids, you've got four kids, you know, your parenting style changes and you adapt to become better at what you're doing, and I guess it's like business. I wanted my business to grow, and I wanted a different life for my children as well. You know, I really wanted to give them the best life possible, and I knew that I'd have to be independent because my ex-husband at the time, you know, we had to pay school and we had to pay this and we had to pay that, and I didn't want to get into the trap of being the expat who couldn't afford to live in the place that we're living. And I knew that business was the only way for me. So for me, it was the only way. Back then, there weren't a lot of positions in my field where I could be, you know, a good breadwinner and provide for my family. And I definitely know my ex-husband did that either in his role. And I don't think that was ever going to change.
Do you think it was almost like an extra thing too? I'm not sure if you would have had this in your head from the start, but by doing that and by creating this business, you became completely almost independent of your husband as well. Like, you didn't have those same conversations of, well, I am now, you know, having to go where he goes or dependent on what he does or his visa rules my life. Like, it all, your situation completely changed from you starting a business in that way, didn't it?
Look, I think I've always been really, really independent in any case. I've always worked. In Dubai, it was the same thing. And then in Qatar, you know, I've always had to have, that's always just been the knock-on effect, you know, the domino hit. You hit the new country and I hit it with the domino effect. I had things that I had to do. I had checklists that I had to do. My checklist wasn't finding where my new coffee shop was going to be. My checklist was, how can I find a job? How can I contribute? How can I do this and be independent? And I definitely think, like what you touched on, I guess it was a blessing that I became so independent living in a new country and I became successful within my own right. Because when my husband did leave the family, I had the ability to stay here. I had the choice, whereas a lot of ladies don't have a choice. You know, a lot of ladies, when the marriages break up, the ladies do have to go back home because they can't sustain a career here to do co-parenting because it's just not possible. Financially, it's not possible.
So, Kimberly, tell us a bit about Starfish Lane Nurseries. Like, how did the business start? How long's it been running for? And what does it look like now?
So we started Starfish, it was nearly 14 years. One branch, you know, about 25 employees. It started very successful from the get-go, and I think it's because I did create something different for Doha. You know, fast forward 14 years, now I have 4 operational Doha, 1 in Abu Dhabi, and I employ over about 120 women. Business is, it's a different time now. Business is going great. I mean, I always have to be really thankful for what I've got, and I know that with my continued hard work and also for my management team, it's just not me. You know, I've got an incredible group of women that work for me, and they've been with me. I've had one lady with me for 14 years, and I've had the majority of my staff, like my strong management team, been with me now for 6 or 7 years. So I'm eternally grateful for them that they also allow me to build the business. Responsibility, you know, there are always stresses when you have this sort of responsibility in a country where we're, my responsibility is that 120 families rely on me, just me, every single month, you know, to make the business grow and to continue to grow the business because, you know, I help 120 families. So I don't take that lightly at all. And I guess that's why I don't have an off button. My off button, you know, I've got more of a pause button now. Before I didn't have an off button, but now I've kind of got that pause button. So, and I delegate. I delegate. I love delegation. And you learn. And it's like parenting, as I said. When you have the first baby, we kind of think we know what we're doing because we read What to Expect When Expecting or whatever the book's called. And I guess we kind of nurture it. We get better and better and better. We let things slide that we know that aren't really necessary in parenting, and it's the same with business. It's the same with building a brand and building a business. We nurture it. We love it. We take baby steps. We learn from it and we grow it.
Kimberly, do you think if you had not left Australia, do you reckon you would have started a children's nursery?
Absolutely not. No. No, it definitely wasn't the direction I wanted to go. But I think as we get older, I think we don't think about things a lot when we're younger, and as young parents, we just kind of go with the flow. And I think as we get older, we take on more responsibility and kind of that effect happens that we feel that, yeah, I can do this. And it's a confidence thing as well. You know, when I was back in Australia, I don't think I would have had the confidence to do it. And there probably wouldn't have been the opportunity to do it, whereas I found the opportunity and my confidence just grows every day with it.
Okay, and last question. Any advice? There will be women, expat women out there now all over the world who are thinking, have I got the guts to do this? Could I start my own business?
Yes.
What would be your advice to them?
I think really just do your research. And, I mean, I don't think it matters what the business is. I think if you believe in yourself and I think if you've got a team of people that can help you, I think go for it. My advice is always employ people that are smarter than you, because I definitely think that, and it's not that I'm stupid, but I'm really great in a lot of areas, but I love it that I can work with people that build me up as I build them up as well, and we share ideas, have a think tank, really see if this is the sort of avenue you want to go. Do your due diligence, do a feasibility study, do a Survey Monkey and find out what the community wants. Have the dedication, understand work-life balance and what that means for you, and make sure that you can implement that. You know, I have many friends that have a lot of children that have children the same as I do, and I still emulate at 51 years of age. I still emulate to want to be like them, because I kind of think, because I've worked so hard, have I missed out on something? But you know what? It's my children that have always told me how proud they are of me. And I kind of think, you know what? We've always got the guilty mum card. Every mum's got it. And I think the fact that my children tell me that they're proud of me and that they want me to do this makes me want to do it. So I've found my own work-life balance. And I think work-life balance for women is a particular thing that everyone should make sure that they've got equal and they can manage that. And also just be true to yourself and have faith in yourself in what you can do and what your ability is.
Wow, Kimberly is quite a dynamo. So many great things about that. One is that she's got 14 years of experience to talk about. So she came to Doha 14 years ago and, as she said, found a niche, and she saw the growth of Doha and wanted to be a part of it. And I know that you've talked about that a lot in your last 9 years in Doha, how much it's changed and how many things are different now to when you first came, and how many things are easier for Western expats than there were when you first came. And that's obviously what she saw and was able to build on that. I loved, 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 always employ people that are smarter than you. I was taught that by my first boss. I don't think it was in reference to myself, but when I was being taught about interview techniques, always look for someone who you think will challenge you, and don't always look for people who you think will just, you know, won't be able to do that. So I think that's a great idea. And other things that she said, which I think are really relevant for people like us or people like her looking in this space, it doesn't matter what the business is. If you've got an idea, just go for it and have faith in yourself and what your ability is, which she obviously did. And she obviously has amazing abilities.
Yeah. And, you know, Nikki, I think so often we think that we've got to find our passion. Do you know, there's been this real move in the last 10, 15 years of find your passion and you'll never work a day in your life, you know, all of that, which is why I wanted to ask Kimberly, you know, would you have done this in Australia? Do you think you would have started a nursery? And she was like, no way would have I done that. And one of the things that I think maybe didn't come through too, Kimberly said, you know, she hires 120 women. Kimberly has given so many women a leg up in that she has trained all of these people in first aid. She's trained them in early childhood. You know, she has created this whole world for women that maybe if they had come here would have perhaps worked as housekeepers or, you know, in different fields. But she has trained them and given them opportunities, and she's done an incredible job. So, yeah, I loved her story. Now, Nikki, who did you speak to?
Well, I spoke to two people, but the first interview I'm going to play for you, Kirsty, is I spoke to Britta, who's also in Doha, but she's in an entirely different point of her business journey to Kimberly. She's right at the beginning, so it gives a bit of a contrast, and it's actually reflecting on her story now after listening to Kimberly. It's exciting to think about where she might go with her business, or where she might not ago. Britta has a business, shirt dresses and more. And I talked to her about how long she's been an expat and what she's done before she started this business.
How did that come about?
Well, that's totally out of my usual profession. I studied hotel administration, and I worked. I've been an expat for like 20 years, working in different countries. And my husband is also from a different country, so we are a mixed marriage. And I had to change my job, my original job, for him in order to move to his country and live with him. So it's like my third or fourth profession, I guess. It's not really a profession, it's more a passion. I like to dress well, and I like clothes like lots of women do. And I'm going to try something new, something I've never tried before, because actually living in Qatar gives me the opportunity to do this, because everywhere here there are lots of tailors, really good tailors, and they have this fabric souk where you can go and choose fabrics, all sorts of fabrics. And this is why I can do it. It's just like a casual business. I don't think I could do it anywhere else.
What were the things that you had to deal with that you didn't imagine you would if you...
My business is still fairly new. I just started like in the end of May or mid-May. I started doing the first dresses. And, you learn, because you, what fabrics to use, what fabrics work with the kind of dress I want to make. How can I, measure, do different sizes. Then, of course, when you go to the market, the fabric market at the local market, and you come there as a Western woman, the price, you have to learn how to negotiate with the fabric sellers. And then you have to learn how to communicate with the tailor, because they are all, most of them are from India, and they speak very little English. And so, you have to kind of draw and use a measuring band and talk with hand and feet. And yeah. I think that's the most difficult part. And then being an expat and, you have your group of people in the country where you live, but I don't really have making contacts, out of your comfort zone, like opening up and the contacts, getting the word out.
Yeah. So what are the barriers to starting a business? Are there any, or you could just decide to just do it immediately?
Well, I just gave it a try. I had nothing to lose. And, I had the time, I had the, the passion and I just wanted to try. And then like in the beginning, it was like sort of technical, with the dressmaking. I made lots of clothes for myself before, but it's easy to just copy a blouse but if you do something from scratch, something completely new, that was one difficulty. And then the other one, getting people to know what I'm doing. That was the most difficult part. But otherwise, there are no, in Qatar, it's really, I started this Facebook page, and what is working most for me is Instagram. Because, I take pictures and then I just try to have people look at the page or follow the page so that they can see what am I offering. And that has been working really well. So obviously I hope to continue to grow my audience and to do more. But like the last 2 months after the summer, it has been picking up. The business has been picking up, and it's going well right now. It keeps me really busy on the days I'm not working. A one-woman show. It's just me, going to the souk, going to the tailor, measuring the clients. Even on my Instagram, I ask a couple of friends of mine to model for me, but, then it's difficult to find, it's my husband who takes the pictures, or a friend. And then, scheduling everybody so that everybody has time is very difficult also.
Do you have a place where they come to see? Or
yes, in my house. I work from home. I have a room which I made my workspace, atelier, where clients can try on clothes, or where I can measure them. It's my home. Yeah, I work from my home. I have one room which I dedicate to the shirt dresses and more business.
Have you sewed before, sewing? You've made clothes before?
No, I only altered my clothes. I've never really sewn clothes. I don't even have earlier when I bought my clothes, I don't know if it had happened to you, when you just buy a dress or a blouse and it's like the length doesn't fit you right, you just want to have it a little bit shorter, or you bought something and you want it a little bit tighter, or it was long sleeve and you just want the short sleeve. So I've been like altering all my off the rack clothes for years, but I've never really made a garment from stretch or sewn myself.
And how did this particular thing come to mind?
I live in Qatar, so it's always hot, very hot. So you need something comfortable, and you're a little bit limited on what you can wear because it's supposed to cover the shoulders, it's supposed to cover the knees. You still want to look nice, you know? So what has been working for me was, just a nice dress, you know, that is cool enough so that you, you know, don't break out in sweat when you're running your errands or going to work. Or even most of my clients are also, like, they work, so they can wear it to work, you know, that it looks nice and proper. Here they like when you work in the office or at a school that you're properly dressed. I've been thinking about a garment that would work, and then I came, you know, and I personally like shirt dresses. You know, you can dress them up, you can dress them down, and that has been working. It has, and I'm offering, to tailor the dresses to any size. So if you're small or if you're bigger, tall or not so tall, doesn't matter. I just make it to your own size, and you can even pick the color. If you're looking for a specific color and you just don't find any in the shops, I just can go and get a red, a green, a purple, or whatever's needed.
What do you think about scaling it then? So you said you're a one-woman show.
Yeah.
Do you have plans to scale it to make it bigger, or?
Yeah, we're taking baby steps. It's like it's quite small still. So if I would have the opportunity to make it bigger, or maybe even collaborate with someone, I would definitely would like to do that. And I had this idea. I saw, like, on social media that there are quite a few women that have the same ideas. You know, it's all like handmade things, jewelry or other clothing. There are lots of women out there that are doing, trying to have, they're having like a little business and maybe collaborate with one of them.
You have never done this before. You hadn't in the other places thought of having your own business, or just it's much easier to do it where you are now?
I always thought about it, but I never had the guts to do it. I think having more time before in the other places I worked full time and having two children, I didn't really have the time to do it. Here, since I only work 2 days a week and I have a lot of, my children have grown a little bit and are more independent. They don't need me around all the time. I just have more time, and not in every city you have a market where you can buy fabrics at a good price, and you don't always have good tailors on hand. So it was just basically just by accident. I mean, I always liked the idea of doing something similar to what I'm doing right now, but I never had the opportunity before. It's just right now was the right time for me to try something new and, yeah, to fulfill something I really like doing, enjoy doing.
What are some of the biggest lessons that you think you've learned so far? What advice would you give to someone else going to start a similar thing to you?
I just to have patience and keep going. And if you really like what you're doing, and then you see that it's working and it's being accepted, and that what I like the most is when one of my clients has a blouse or a dress and they're really happy with it, you know, and they know it's unique. It's just for them. It was made for them, and they're really happy, and they're sending me pictures afterwards, and they said, oh, I come back for more. That makes you feel really, really good. And so you enjoy what you're doing. You just have to be very patient, I think, and not just give up. You know, there were a couple of times where I said, why am I doing this? You know, but why am I investing so much of my time and energy into this? But I'm enjoying it. And it's when you do something you really like, and you see that you can make other people happy with it, and you support another local business, which is the tailor and the shops down on the market. It's nice.
And what do you wish that you'd known before you started that you know now?
I wish I would know more maybe about social media and marketing, how to sell things more. I'm not really, you know, I'm not a sales expert. I'm still learning in the learning process about that.
Okay, I find it very funny that Britta says she needs to know more about social media, because that's exactly how I discovered her. She popped up in my Instagram feed. Now, I was scrolling through Instagram, and this business kept popping up called Shirt Dresses and More. And it is exactly that. It's beautiful shirt dresses. And she does these amazing little belts that go with them, and that it's the fabric that she's choosing. And she is bang on when she was talking about, because it's so hot here, but you can't wear, well, you know, you're not meant to wear, and things have changed, but you're not really meant to wear shoestring strap tops or, you know, short skirts. So you're always looking for something that kind of covers your knee or has something over your shoulders. And a lot of people will wear a pashmina over the top, you know, of a short sleeve shirt. But these dresses are exactly that, that you look at them and you go, oh, I could wear that. That looks amazing. And she does. She has a real talent for choosing amazing fabric and these amazing belts that go around them. And they really do go with all sizes. So I was quite attracted to that because I was thinking comfy, looks really good. Doesn't, you know, you don't have to be a size 8 to jump in one. But I just, the thing that I thought really was really interesting about her business was, I would have thought that she was making them from scratch, but the fact that she's worked out, oh no, I just have to source the fabric, I have to explain it to a tailor, and then I just make the adjustments of that. I think it's brilliant. And, you know, I hadn't thought that that was what was going on, but it just was another, to me, another example of, you can use other people to help you in your business. You don't have to do it all from scratch. Do you know? You can use what's around you. And the one thing that is around us here is probably access to cheaper materials. And
yeah, it didn't make it into the podcast, I don't think, but I asked her, does she think she's getting the best price on the materials at the moment? She said she thinks she's got a little way to go. She's become a more regular customer. She feels more confident about that. But another thing she said, which I didn't laugh, but I just smiled at, because I have never had this thought in my life, but when you buy something off the rack, Kirsty, and it's got long sleeves and you want to make it short sleeves, don't you just go home and do that?
I laughed at that as well, because I know that there are oodles of things I've bought that I should do that with, because, you know, everybody says that too, like that you should have everything adjusted solely for you, like that little tuck in at the waist or just to put it right at the right length. No, can't say I've ever rushed off and done that. I'm one of those people, Nikki, because I think there are two types of people when it comes to buying clothes. I'm one of those people that I just about wear at home from the shop, whereas I'm always amazed when I meet people and they pull something out of their wardrobe that's got a tag on it that they bought 6 months ago. And it's like, how have you not worn that? Like, I would have worn that the next day.
I totally agree. Whenever I try on clothes, I think I'm going to buy that. I put my own clothes back on and I think, oh, why am I even wearing this? This looks terrible. I'm just a wear it home for the shop girl. Now, I also spoke to Tara in Oslo in Norway. She's lived there for 4 years and she's got a 2.5-year-old and an 8-month-old baby. And she recently returned to work full time because her husband is on his portion of her parental leave, because in Norway the parents can share the 12 months. Mm-hmm. So Tara spoke to me at 9 p.m. after a full day at work, a farewell function for a colleague and putting her kids to bed. So I was tired after listening to that. And the business I spoke to her about was not any of those things. It's an additional thing that she does, and it's called Oslo Soup. And I'll play you the interview and she can tell you about it.
Can you just talk about what it actually is? Yeah. I've read about it, but you probably could explain it much better than I could for our listeners.
Sure. So Oslo Soup is, we like to call it a microfunding foodie experience. And basically what we do is we host 3 events a year. And at the event, you would attend and donate some money at the door. It could be, we recommend about 50 kroner, but we also have some raffles to try and encourage people to donate more. And what you get for that is you get to listen to 4 different groups pitch their community idea for Oslo. You get to eat soup and cake and bread and network with the people that attend. And then you vote on your favorite project. And we tally all the votes, and whoever gets the most votes during the event takes home all the money we have raised. And that money is supposed to be used to kickstart the idea that they have just pitched. So it's been a pretty fun thing. We do it 3 times a year because we're all working and don't have time to do it more often. I also think it's a good balance right now with the amount of projects we get. We also work with all these local businesses to donate everything. So the space is donated, the food is donated, the raffles are donated. The only thing we've done that's cost us money is we've done a few like little attempts to get money ourselves to buy things like a microphone, an amp, some cauldrons, I call them. I'm not even sure if that's the right word, but to keep the soup hot, these like basic stuff. we have been able to crowdfund that ourselves through other ways, not during the event though.
So when did you start this enterprise?
We started it before I got my job, actually. It was after I was here for like a month plus, I realized that my introvertedness was going to probably get the best of me if I continued down the path that I was going, which was, you know, listening to audiobooks and not talking to anyone. And so I decided to try and join a meetup where I could meet people in the city because I knew no one. So I joined this meetup and we met a bunch of other expat ladies, most of them here for love. We hit it off. A lot of us, we would go to get a drink together or lunch. We had like a burger hunt for a while, best burger in Oslo, and did these things. And then one of the ladies was telling us about this concept from Detroit Soup. It's also pretty big in the UK. And she said, well, I think we ought to start it in Oslo. So four of us got together and decided to do that. And that was in November of 2015. And we had our first event in April of 2016.
Okay. And so the four of you did it. Were there anyone that had been there a bit longer? What did you have to do to physically set it up if it's a not-for-profit, right?
Right. So we didn't register immediately because, honestly, we were a little concerned that the organization really wouldn't hit it off, because Norway here has so many different options to fund people. And then, like, with the way that it's so socially involved, we just weren't sure if there would be a need for this like micro funding money. Like maybe everyone's getting the money they need. Maybe we're going to get a lot of really weird projects, but it turns out that this small amount of money is really nowhere to be found. If you want to get 100,000 kroner, you know, which is about 10,000 euros, you have avenues, but to get like 7,000 kroner, 8,000 kroner, there's really not like organizations out there that are doing these little micro grants. So we didn't register immediately and we kind of tested it out a little bit. You don't have to register if you don't take a certain amount of money in. So we weren't taking any money in, to be honest with you.
How do people know about you? How did you advertise?
It's been pretty grassroots. I think in the beginning, because the event is held in English, we've really hit a lot of the expat immigrant communities here. Mm-hmm. And so then it's been word of mouth since then. And so now we're in a really unique situation where people are coming to us and asking to donate to us and asking to be a part of the of an event, and which is just so cool. So it's, I mean, Oslo is a small city, so things can move quickly. Otherwise, what we do is we have a Facebook page, we have a website, we do have a Twitter, which I use very infrequently. It's not a huge Twitter's not huge here in Norway. And Instagram. So we try to just connect as best as we can. And the people that donate to us have also been really good about sharing our posts or liking our stuff. And it just kind of works from there. I mean, our events aren't huge, but we have anywhere between 70 and 100 people come on a Sunday afternoon and join us.
And do you get updates from the people that won the money?
Yeah. So one of the things they have to agree to when they ask to pitch is that they have to come back to the next event or one shortly thereafter. We've made a few exceptions for baptisms or weddings and things like that, you know? Yeah. So they have to come back and tell us how it's going, even if it didn't go well, like even if their idea flopped, it's okay. You know, come back, tell us what challenges you hit. You don't know if somebody in the audience might be interested in working with you, or if not, you know, just let people learn from the experiences that you went through. But most of the time we have some really nice stories about how things have really kicked off and been successful.
And is there any, the four of you that set it up, are you all short, medium, long-term Oslo residents? How does that work?
So the only person that's still on the board is me. But we have one of the women that was an original founder is still our MC, but she's just got a lot more responsibilities at her full-time job. So she just does what she can, but she's not technically on the board anymore. One of the other ladies decided to step down for personal reasons, and then somebody else moved to Copenhagen. But we were lucky to have volunteers that have been with us from the very first event. So we've been able to get other board members that have been there from the beginning, just not exactly the first meetings of should we do this or not, but the first events. Some of the projects that have come out, the most recent winner, she wants to set up a small repair corner inside libraries or other community centers so she can actually help people repair their own clothing to try and just keep it a bit more sustainable. And she made a really interesting point when she was pitching. She said, you know, like, you might need to just do something simple to a pair of pants, but it might be cheaper to buy it in H&M and you just throw your other pants away, which is a shame. It's a real shame to just like kind of toss this stuff that could be perfectly fine. And so she wants to help people. She'll have the supplies, and that's what she's using the money for. Get a sewing machine. And she's already had a little event this past weekend where she taught people to make bags for your vegetables to reuse at the grocery store. So it's very simple ideas. But we haven't really seen any losers, to be honest with you, because the crowd networks during it. Like we had two pitchers that didn't end up winning at one of our events as an example, and they ended up writing a book together. You know, they like worked together and did this other project. And we've also we've seen that happen a few times, which is really cool to see the networking work. I mean, even the woman that won this last time, had she not won, in the middle of her, or after her pitch was done, they had the four people ask questions. One of the women in the crowd just said, "I have a sewing machine and I want to give it to you." You know, these things kind of happen sometimes, and it's amazing to see that connection. And we do still share, too. So some of the people that, you know, quote unquote, don't win the money, will continue to share about their project if they keep us in the loop so that people can continue to support them in different ways. We stuck pretty closely to what they do in Detroit Soup. The only thing that we joke about is they like offer soup and salad, and we decided salad just wasn't our thing, and so we swapped it for cake. Cake does bring people. Everything's donated. So, I mean, we have a lot of donors each event. We don't ever try to put the pressure on one person to cover up to 100 people, for instance. Mm-hmm. But local bakers and local caterers might donate one cake or two cakes. And then we just advertise them the best we can. I mean, we're all pretty active on social medias. Whenever somebody's asking about buying a birthday cake, for instance, we're plugging everyone we know. But it's been great. We have a lot of repeat donors, which makes a life a lot easier. So we're a registered volunteer organization here in Norway. The other thing that we did was literally kind of a crowdfunding platform online for a few weeks. It's a Norwegian one called Bidra. And we just said, hey, we need this, that, or the other. And then people that supported us donated, which was great. You know, the people that I work with on Oslo Soup are become my family in that way. I can depend on them if I need somebody to watch my kid for a few hours, you know, and these other things that come up, because otherwise you can be quite isolated. So this was an important step, at least personally for me, to be a bit more connected.
Okay, there's two things that I really love about this, and this is one of my favorite things. Nikki, I love that we've had small business, larger business, and then community business. I think we've covered everything here. But I loved at the beginning when Tara was saying that she had recognized that she was an introvert and she needed to do something to kind of push herself along with that, to meet people, that was her personality. And I think so many of us could learn from Tara, do you know? Like, it's to be able to say, I'm an introvert, I'm going to struggle with this whole expat gig if I don't give myself a push. So I'm going to find something I can do where I'm involved with other people, but I don't have to be front and center. I don't have to be the spokesperson or the whatever, but I just want to be involved in something. And I love that it's a non-for-profit, that it's community, that it's microfunding. I love that so often as expats, we think that we have to jump into other people's communities and become a part of that community. But quite often, maybe we just have to create a community of our own and invite people to come and join our community. You know, maybe if you're finding it hard to get into someone else's, well, then make something of your own and build something from there. Yeah, I just thought she was fantastic, and that it wasn't completely original. Like she said, that there is Detroit soup, and so you can borrow an idea. Yeah.
Have you ever heard about that before?
I hadn't, but there were lots of people in the Facebook group that had.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then I went and had a look, and on Detroit Soup, it's got on their website, it's got a list of all the soup/ places around the world, and there are hundreds of them, and they're just all casually linked by the fact that they're all into microfunding, which I think is fantastic. Yeah. And I also think all the other opportunities that are available to Tara, I mean, for an introvert, she talked about networking a lot, and the fact that all the people involved in that are getting together, and it is a way into other things and just sit and collaboration and other bits and pieces that you might not think of. So being involved in it as a volunteer or even just going along as an expat in a new country could really open up so many things to you that you hadn't even thought about.
Yeah, absolutely. Like when she said that the person in the crowd sort of shouted out, oh, I've got a sewing machine that I can give you. And you can sense that that's the feeling of the room. It's this feeling of, oh, what a great idea. I'd like to help you with that, or I'd like to talk to you about that. I'd like to meet you. You're interesting. I'm interested in that. Yeah, it's just such a fantastic idea. And, you know, Nikki, I'm just thinking on the fly, but maybe we can create, you know, in the past we've created checklists in podcasts, but maybe for this one we can create a link to expat businesses. Like we'll just do a PDF of these people's businesses with their website and whatever, so people could access it. We could do that so that people can find it easily. So I'd also encourage, if you have a business, to let us know about it and tell us about it. Tell us what you do, how you started it, and we'll include it.
Perfect.
Okay, Nikki, I wanted to talk to you about a review that we had this week.
Oh, yay, reviews.
Yay, reviews. Nikki, it's amazing how if you ask people very nicely if they will rate or review your podcast, they actually do. Now, I'm not sure why we hadn't thought about this before.
Don't stop.
Please, guys, keep going. But I wanted to talk to you about one because I think this is great. It's a podcast that I listen to called, I always have to get the actual podcast, it's called Long Distance Call, which is LDC. So my little story of how this fits in with my personal life is, Nikki, you know, we have a beach house in Australia and I spend a bit of time there. I have a neighbour down the road who's lovely, but I don't really talk a lot about what I do in my expat life with people at the beach. So I might not mention that I've got a podcast or that I'd created this Facebook group that now has sort of 19,000 people in it with you, Nikki, and that, you know, or that I have a expert blog. And so this woman who lives down the road, she said to me, oh, Kirsty, you know, you're an expat. You might really like this podcast called LDC. It's a expat, you know, it's got a woman on it who's an expat. And I was like, oh, interesting. Yes, I should have listened. Anyway, the two people in this podcast are Eliza Blue and Geraldine Duke, who are a mother-daughter team. Eliza is a journalist and she's married to someone who's working in Beirut at the moment as a journalist, and her mother Geraldine Duke is a well-known radio and I guess television too presenter for the ABC in Australia. They have a podcast where they, and I have to say I'm a bit triggered by it, they have a Skype and I do find it very triggering because that's how I used to talk to my boss, was via Skype. So every time I hear that noise, I think, what now? Anyway, Eliza left a really lovely review for us and I really appreciate it. She said, I love this podcast. I've been listening to it for 2 years in both Asia and the Middle East and I learn something new every week. I'm particularly enjoying the latest season. Thank you, Eliza. We are really trying to make this season a little different than last in that, A, we're trying to be a little bit more organised, but also we're really trying to find inspiring stories from expats all around the world, and I think we're actually doing that. Eliza said, thank you, Kirsty and Nikki, for sharing your wisdom and hard work. So thank you very much. So please, guys, if you would like to leave us a review, We love them. They really do make our day, and it makes it worth the ringing around and the interviews and the chasing up and the Google Docs and everything else. So thank you very, very much.
Three favorite things, Kirsty. What have you got on the table this week?
Okay. So I was listening to Chats 10 Looks 3 a week or two ago. I'm not sure if it was an older episode, but Monica Lewinsky's name came up, and Lee Sayles was saying, you know, that she'd gone back and listened to Monica's TED Talk. And I thought, oh, I missed that. I think it was about 2015, that TED Talk. And the whole public shaming thing seems to have come back into conversation again. John Ronson's, who wrote So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and I'm sure I've spoken to you about this before, Nikki. I went and saw John Ronson speak in London, yeah. And I thought he was phenomenal. And I always talk about the impact of just this 10-minute speech that he did. So I wanted to go back and look at Monica's TED Talk, which I did last night, and it really is brilliant. And if you've got, you know, if you've got 10 minutes to sort of scroll through, I'm sure it's probably on YouTube. I just went to TED.com and looked at it.
I think it's 25 minutes. But
Was it 25 minutes?
Yeah, because you get so caught up with it, you don't realize. Like it's one of the longer ones. Yeah, I watched it recently too.
She does it so well, doesn't she, Nikki?
Yeah. Like,
she's got a little stand in front of her, which I gather is her speech is on, but she just doesn't seem to turn a page or look down at it very often at all, does she? Like it's,
no.
She speaks well. And I know this has got nothing to do with it, but how amazing does she look as well?
Yeah. For being, yes, 41. More than 41 in that, I think.
Oh,
anyway, she was born in 1973.
Ah, so yeah, because she was saying, oh, so she must have been, so she kicks off, she talks about being at a Forbes 30 under 30 or whatever, and that she was 41. And the guy said to her, I'll make you feel like a 22-year-old or something. Anyway. Totally, totally worth going back and listening to, because, you know, you'll probably rethink some of your thoughts when you go back to think about who she was and what she went through. But it's also a really good timestamp on social media, and because social media wasn't around then, but the whole online world was just kicking off. And she explains that she was one of the first online stories that sort of got more clicks, and that it was all about getting the clicks than the daily newspapers, that hers was one of those big stories that kicked off, you know, online newspapers. But one thing that popped up was I saw recently a friend, you know, shared, you know, a supposed tweet of Monica's saying, showed her face, her Twitter handle, and it said, I'm willing to take one for the team to give Trump a blowjob in the Oval Office. Apparently that's the only thing that can convince Republicans to impeach. And I read it and sort of thought, funny, but it's not true. She didn't write it at all. Someone else wrote it and shared it. And I have seen good friends of mine reshare that around, and I just thought, here we go again. The woman's being completely publicly shamed yet again, even after all of this.
Yeah, it was the first thing when I saw the tweet, it was the first thing I did. I thought, there's no way she wrote that, given her recent public. Like she has got a Twitter game. She does do some good stuff.
Yes.
She has made some very clever commentary on Twitter lately, but I thought there's no way that's her. And, of course, immediately you could find out that it wasn't her. But, again, you had to look into it.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that, and now with the speed that, I mean, that's something people scroll past, giggle, snort, or say that's disgusting and then move on. But it's still attributed to her in their mind.
Yes.
And so it's just really, it's terrible that happens. And her TED speech really gives the timeline of online shaming, as you say, and the rollout and how it was. And one thing that she talked about where she said that the feeling of humiliation when measured by psychologists or on an emotional scale is worse than anger or laughter. So if you feel humiliated, that's a more deeply felt feeling than either of those things. So it was really, and there were some very poignant moments in there as well. And
so many. When she said, she used a phrase where she said, you know, I've been seen by many, known by few. There was the bit where she explained having to listen to those tapes of herself. And I was thinking, yeah, she's 22. She's gossiping to her workmate. She's, in love with her boss. She's everything that all of us could take ourselves back to 22 and think about phone calls. You know, I used to go out with a group of friends every Saturday morning, and it was all women, and we were always hungover, and we would rehash the night before and who picked up who and who did what and whatever and what happened. And I think back now to anyone who would have been sitting anywhere in our vicinity listening to us as young women of what we thought was important at that time. And it was, you know, the best time of my life maybe, but I'm not sure I was as deep as I possibly thought I was. But she talks about listening to these tapes of her speaking, and that all those tapes were shared with everyone. But like she says, it was like listening to the very worst version of myself. But Nikki, her parents, when she described about and how her mother had relived it all with other young people who have now since been publicly shamed. And when she talked about how her mother had, you know, they'd made her shower with the door open because they were worried about her. And they were worried about her being basically humiliated to death. It was just, it's very good, isn't it?
It really makes you look at it, because at the time, I have to say, as a young woman myself, I was just laughing along with everybody else at the late night jokes and all that kind of stuff. And now I am horrified by it and shamed by it. And, you know, with age comes wisdom and reflection. But I don't know whether it was a sign of the times or what it is. I also think it wouldn't happen to the same extent now, because there is so much noise now. There is so much, like she said, she was the first and she was the biggest and whatever. But I think now I want to say that news cycle would be over more quickly. Doesn't mean the impact on her would be any less. Mm. But I think that, I mean, I know that there was an impeachment and a trial and it went on and on and on. But I think that in the hurly burly of today's news and shock and horror stories, I think that would be, it wouldn't have the same imprint on across all media as it does now. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think this would be different?
So if we were going to put it in a context of today, well, actually, it's funny if you look at the two different presidents, isn't it?
Yeah.
If Obama was to have received a blowjob in the Oval Office, I think that would have been absolutely everywhere. If Trump was to receive a blowjob in the Oval Office, I don't think people would even blink.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
I was speaking about John Ronson and how much I loved the book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. If you haven't read the book, BBC have released in July an audio recording of it. It's in 6 episodes. But, yeah, go back. I'll put a link to it. It's BBC, John Ronson, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. All right. So the other thing, what I've been watching, Nikki, have you seen anything about this? It's on ABC iView. It's called Total Control.
I have, but I haven't watched it.
Oh,
but I want to.
I watched the first episode a couple of nights ago. Deb Mailman, who is in Offspring, and Rachel Griffith. It's set in Winton, far west Queensland. Well, that's where it starts. And I did see that there was 170 cast members and crews that landed in Winton for 5 weeks of filming. It's a fantastic beginning. It gets you in straight away. But it's basically the story of an Aboriginal woman based in Winton who is involved in what does become a viral sensation or viral incident. There's a situation in family court where an angry husband comes, hits his wife, she intervenes, there's a death, but she is part of this huge story and becomes, I guess, a bit of an icon, an Australian icon, and ends up working in Parliament, which you totally, when you watch it, you're going, oh, yeah, I could see how this could happen. I could totally see how this could happen. It's fantastic. Rachel Griffith plays the Prime Minister. It gives you a great sort of insight into Canberra and how things work. It's very well written. It's very well shot. I think it's going to be fantastic and loving it. What about you? Tell me one of your favourite things, Nikki Moffat.
Okay, so for the podcast I've been listening to this week, The Mysterious Mr. Epstein, which is a Wondery podcast, so it's done by the same people that did Dirty John. So for all those that remember and love Dirty John. And it's really the backstory of, well, it's going to investigate the whole thing. So there's only three episodes that have dropped so far. And, of course, he recently passed away in jail, and it was
controversial, but I think it was ruled a suicide.
But he was in jail on charges of sex trafficking of children, pedophilia related stuff. And so it sort of goes back into it reaches everywhere because it's one of these stories. And I was thinking about it yesterday when I was listening. Why do we find this so fascinating? Why do these people get away with things for so long? And what is it that actually brings them down? And basically, it investigates that. So it says that this one reporter issued this one article, and this article is the thing that started the ball rolling that eventually brought it all down. But there'd been reporters that did articles before, and there'd been investigations before, and nothing went anywhere. And it's just sort of trying to unravel who he was, what his life was like, and what really happened. Because now, because there won't be a court case, because he's died, you know, everyone wants it to be a closed book because of, you know, it involves everything. I mean, in the Australian media, there are pictures of Catherine Keating, who's the former Prime Minister's daughter, leaving his house in New York, I think. Wow. I mean, everyone, you know, Prince Andrew, Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, everyone in some way has been involved or in photos or videos with this guy. And so people want to know who he was and how he had this amazing influence and how nothing ever happened to him.
I think it's all power and fear, isn't it? That people get a certain amount of power and then they wield great fear to others where people won't ever stand up because they're too frightened of what will happen to them, and they know that this powerful person will just get away with it over and over and over again. Okay, I Spy with my little expat eye was something in the New York Times this week. It was called Weeknight Dinner Around the World. So the New York Times did 18 families having dinner around the world, and the New York Times do this very well. Nikki, I think we've talked about different ones they've done before where we've seen a child's bedroom around the world, or we've seen, you know, a day at work around the world. So, but this one is, what does weeknight dinner look around the world? And we have Thailand and India and Rome and Riyadh and Israel and France. They did Western Australia for Australia, and I immediately had to go and have a look. They were having fish for dinner.
Fish.
But it is really, really interesting. I'll put the link there, and you can just see it's, you know, it's everything. It's sort of like what time they eat, who's there at the table, what's on the table, you know, what that dining room looks like. Are they sitting right in the middle of the kitchen, or are they actually moving and sitting at the dining table in a different area of the house? And I'm always interested in this, Nikki, because I remember listening to a conversation years ago with Sarah McDonald from the ABC. It was a podcast, I reckon, where Sarah McDonald and Rebecca Huntley talked about dinners, that, you know, family dinners. And I reckon Sarah McDonald was saying, oh, that they don't eat at the dinner table anymore, that everyone's busy and, you know, quite often dinner's on your lap. And I'm really interested in this because we do eat at the table every night. It's the one thing we do as a family. It's when we have a chat. And if I had to talk about now what my favourite memories are with my family and my favourite moments are with my family, it's particularly at the beach. We will eat and just sit there for hours, you know, at the table after dinner and talk. And quite often, if it's summer, you know, we're sitting outside on the deck and things get done, like dishes get – the dishwasher gets packed and things happen or whatever, but it's that bit where you just stay and you keep talking and the kids actually talk to each other and, you know, there's no devices and there's no anything. And I'm always amazed that if you don't have that, if you're sitting on the couch eating your meal, you don't – do you get that? I don't know. Nikki, what does your family do for dinner?
Yeah, we're not good at that. My kids and I eat dinner and then, or I wait till my husband comes home and then I'll eat it with him in the kitchen. Right. But the kids will already be done.
Yes.
So we don't often have a sit down as a family. And when we do, there's often a lot of grumbling about it,
right?
Which is not ideal. Which is why we sometimes say, "Well, we'll just go out to dinner then." Like, let's go out. Like on the first week that Sam was away in Copenhagen, and he came back, he said, "I'll meet you for dinner." So we all went out for dinner. So we knew that we were all going to be together and be focused on one thing. Like if we're at home, people would want to have, you know, on Fridays we have takeout at home. That's our takeout night. So, you know, and if people have different takeouts, they come at different times and, you know, it's dramatic. It's not really, but it can be, you know, or, you know, I've just got my pizza and I just want to eat it in peace, etc. So it's Friday. I've been at school all week, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, we're not great at that. We're not great at family meals. When we travel, when we go on holidays and stuff like that, and when we go out, but we're not that great at it at home, I have to admit.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think my mum would say that I've heard her say this, her favourite times for us as a family when I was growing up was doing the dishes, because she said she felt that that's when people really spoke, was that one person would wash, two people would dry, one person, you know, would put away, and that there was she remembers lots of fun. And
yeah,
you know,
it's like being in the car, right? So your kids talk to you more in the car because everyone's doing something, driving, whatever. Doing the dishes is a little bit like that. Everyone's actually concentrating on one thing, but you can do other things because of it.
Yes. Speaking of which, I was in the car with 3 out of 4 of my children yesterday before we were going to the airport, and we were nearly involved in a horrific accident where someone just out of nowhere, it was almost like they wanted us to hit them. They just cut straight across 2 lanes of traffic right in front of us, where we had to slam on the brakes and the car made that awful noise, you know, where you do. And then we proceeded to laugh about it hysterically for the next 10 minutes. And I was thinking how funny it is in a time of catastrophe in a family where not a word was said, like in the heat of the moment, and we all talked about what was going through our minds, right, when it happened. That this, it's a split second, right, where you slam on the brakes and there's this, but there was no words. Like I would have thought.
No one screamed.
No one screamed. No one swore. No one said anything. Like there was just this dead silence of this. And then we were all saying what we were thinking. And a child number 2, Annabelle, says, "I was just thinking Dad's going to kill us when he gets back from China," because Greg had only left that morning to go to China. And he said, "I was just thinking Dad's going to think, I only left this morning and you've crashed the car and I've only been gone for a few hours." And Fred said that he was thinking, "Wow, I didn't think it would make that noise in that, you know, like that's a weird noise. What is that noise? I didn't think it would make that noise." And I was thinking, shit, how are we going to get to the airport when we don't have a car? Because we're But it was just quite funny. We were all giggling about it. I was thinking, you know, those moments when you're together, I think we rob ourselves so much now, don't we, of that, those shared family moments when you're all together, because we're all so busy and we're all heading off left, right and centre, and, you know, or someone's got a device in their hand and they're not thinking, someone's got AirPods in, they're not a part of it. Do you know, all those banal little things that happen are often the most fun things that you have to remember. That you say, like, I know that the kids will all say over the next years, remember when we nearly had that car accident in Doha? It will, it will become bigger than what it actually was. But yeah, sorry, I'm way off track. But I just thought the dinners around the world, and I think it's interesting, you know, how we do all have dinner around the world, and what that dinner table looks like, if there is one.
Perfect. Okay. It's time to say goodbye. Before we say goodbye, we'd just like to remind you that we do have a website, www.twofatexpats.com. We also have an Instagram account at Two Fat Expats, and of course our lovely Facebook group, Two Fat Expats. We would also love for you to give us a review on any particular device or podcast platform that you listen to us on. Please, please, please. We love reviews.
Okay. I'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.